Well, once again, welcome everyone to another edition of the Canadian Real Estate Insider Conference Call Series. Today we're going to offer a little bit of perspective of what's going on in the marketplace, and we have probably one of the most well-known experts across Canada to help us weed through what's going on with the banks and financing and CMHC buying out mortgages, prime rates dropping, mortgage rates disappearing. What's going on and what do we do? So today we have on the line Canada's number two mortgage broker across the country is going to help weed through all the headlines and all the news and maybe give a little bit of perspective to what's going on. So the first thing I want to do is welcome to the call Mr. Peter Kinch. Welcome, Peter.
Well, thanks, Russ. It's great to be with you today.
Well, we have a very aggressive agenda going forward here. I have lots of questions, and you know what? Are you okay, Peter, if I just start firing them off and just...
Yeah, well, I can't think of any particular topics that we'd have anything to talk about. There's nothing going on in the markets these days.
You know what? I had to cut it down to about four pages of questions because I said, okay, this is too much. It's not that there's not a shortage of things that is going on. And what I'm going to also preface this for everyone that's going to be listening to the call, we are recording this at the end of October, early November 2008. Pay attention because things may change next week. So this is a snapshot as it stands right now.
Yeah, we're right before Halloween, actually. So
absolutely.
Scary time.
Scary time. I know not everyone on the call will that's listening to this recording will maybe have heard of you, Peter. I thought before we get into all the meat and potatoes that we got lined up today, I thought I'd maybe just give everyone who's listening maybe just a real quick background of where you got started. I know you have a really interesting story from all the way starting from Japan and how you got into the mortgage brokering industry. So how did someone go from your story, I believe, teaching English in Japan to becoming the number two mortgage broker in Canada? Maybe just a little background on where you've come from.
Well, it seems like an obvious transition to me, but actually, it's a funny story because, you know, there I was sitting in 100 miles north of Tokyo teaching English in Japan and ran across a Japanese businessman, and this guy wanted to buy real estate in Canada. And at the time, I really didn't have a clue of any of that type of business. And all I knew is I knew this mortgage broker out of Victoria, and I hooked the two of them up, and long and short of it, within 2 months, I found myself in the middle of an international real estate transaction that this guy ended up buying Kimberley Ski Resort. And
just a fun one for your first transaction, just a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Suffice to say, the mortgage broker said, hey, have you ever thought of being a mortgage broker for real estate? And, you know, it's like when we returned from Japan in 1994, that's what I got into. And fast forward about 5 years, I got a phone call from an individual who was working with real estate investors and wanted me to work on a project. And again, fast forward another year or so, I found myself doing $10, $20, $30 million a year of annual business working with real estate investors. And what was interesting, Russ, is as I started working with investors, I started recognizing patterns. I started realizing that the real estate investor is a completely different animal than the homeowner. When a homeowner has a job and a T4 and a pay stub and they're buying one property, you're maybe only dealing with them once. There's one transaction there, and they might not renew for another 5 years. So it's kind of what I call a transactional approach. And you know, all the training I had was looking at the deal, answering the questions, and giving the person what they asked for. And what was interesting with working with the real estate investors is when I did the transactional approach that I was trained to do, I quickly realized that I could inadvertently be doing a disservice to that real estate investor because every real estate investor was not only interested in the transaction at hand, but also had a bigger picture in mind. So I started realizing that these individuals had goals that went beyond the transaction. And as such, I started analyzing more and asking people about their goals. And like I said before, I started recognizing patterns, and I started realizing that certain banks didn't like working with investors. Certain banks did. Certain banks had special products. So I analyzed and studied those products. And before you knew it, I was able to become a specialized expert in that area. Rather than a GP, I became a surgeon. And then, of course, get introduced to people such as yourself and Don Campbell and the Real Estate Investment Network. open up more opportunities for me to further develop the science of working with the real estate investor. And eventually we developed a concept called a portfolio approach to mortgage lending as opposed to transactional approach. And the portfolio approach took into consideration the full picture, the long-term goals, how today's purchase interacts with your long-term goals and needs, and making sure that today's mortgage is not only serves today's purpose but also helps you accomplish those long-term goals. And it became a completely different approach to mortgage financing. And as such, we developed an expertise across the country for working with real estate investors, and that is what eventually propelled me to being in a position where we could be recognized as the number two volume producer in Canada.
Well, that's some significant accomplishment from, what is that, 14 years from, brokering, not knowing what you're doing, brokering your first deal, and you probably have only cranked it up maybe in the last 5 or 6 years.
No, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I remember back to that first time that we met, and I tell this story quite often, is that you were the first mortgage broker that I ever met that asked me, before we were going to do a deal, you didn't ask me my net worth or my income or anything. You asked me what my goals were and and how you could help me with that. And like I said back then, I knew I found a good mortgage broker when he's more interested in finding out what my goals are than just getting a deal done. So I applaud you for always having that that attitude in the back of your mind with that and helping people at the same time. As we know, as most RAIN members or people on our newsletter know, that when we have anyone coming to the table or talking or teaching about real estate or anything, they're also real estate investors as well. I know you've got a significant holding. So what are you currently up to right now with your real estate business aside from your mortgage broker business?
If you were talking to me about a couple of weeks ago, it was refinancing. What I'm currently working on, I've got a large project. We're able to secure a building, commercial building in Port Moody. My office is in Port Moody right now, and I own one unit, rent another unit. It was a kind of interesting story, and what I was able to do was a complete result of my affiliation with RAIN and my knowledge as a broker, I guess. But I engaged a commercial realtor, and I said, "Hey, listen, I need to get a building. I need 2,000 square feet for my new office, and I don't want to lease it. I want to own it." So we looked in the area where I live in Port Moody, just outside of Vancouver, and he said, "There's nothing for sale. There's absolutely not a single commercial building for sale, except for the fact that Polygon, which is a large developer, real estate developer here, was developing a master plan community. All in total would be about 3,000 homes with condos, towers, townhouses, et cetera. And they had the city mandated that they had a commercial component to it. So I said, great, go tell them I'll buy 2,000 square feet off the commercial building. Well, we did that, and then they came back and said, sorry, no, we're not interested in piecemealing this. You either take the whole thing or nothing at all. And long and short of it, I looked at that, and I thought, I don't want to take on a whole entire building. But then I realized everything that RAIN has taught us made me realize that, wait a second, there's multiple ways to skin the cat, so to speak. So even though I haven't got the answer right now, I committed to the building and took it off the market. And this was about just under a year ago. And we closed in August. And originally I was going to carve it up, stratify it, and sell off the pieces. But as it turned out, we were able to not stratify it, but rather lease out the rest of the building. And it's proven to become a phenomenal cash-flowing investment for my family, and it really is going to be the corner piece of my retirement pension. And I was able to finance the entire project by refinancing my earlier investments in Alberta, Peace River, Edmonton, and areas like that. So it's been a very successful year in that sense.
You're a very good, astute person who follows what the system teaches, and I tell you what, as you mentioned earlier, there's no two ways, there's different ways of accomplishing your goal, but the key thing is you have to have your goal in place. So how about we get serious for a minute here, Peter? Let's get right down to all the negative doom and gloom that's going on right now. Are you ready for it?
Okay.
Exactly. So
key to music.
Exactly. Let's take it back a step first. I think a lot of this started hitting national media probably about a year ago. It was about a year ago, mm-hmm. in August, when we started seeing some headlines about these subprime mortgage things and asset-backed commercial paper and mortgage-backed securities and all these kind of fancy terms that no one had any awareness of. And then all of a sudden we started seeing it in the paper, and then all of a sudden a tumble effect started happening. Maybe if you could just take us back in about a year, you know, maybe explain, A, what a subprime mortgage is, and also why are these things starting to cause some financial concerns in the marketplace?
Yeah, sure, Russ. You know, and it's funny because you look at a year ago, people around the water cooler at work, and you know, you can imagine the dinner table conversations about, yeah, I heard there's a subprime crisis, and at the same time, I was at a rain workshop, and then somebody came up to me and said, "Hey, how do I get one of those subprime mortgages?" I said, "Why do you want one?" He goes, "Well, I want my interest rate to be below prime, you know, subprime, right?" I said, "No, you're confusing it here. Says, the interest rate isn't what's below prime; you are."
A very big difference.
Yeah, and it's funny. Now it became part of our vernacular in the last year, but really a year ago, the majority of people didn't really understand what it was. And you know, Russ, what's really interesting, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about this, because I think it's critical that we take a second and talk about what American subprime mortgage is as opposed to Canadian subprime, because, you know, it's amazing. Again, I had a really good friend of mine last year when all this stuff was happening. He said, "Well, I'm sure glad I put down 25%. I said, to get my house." And I said, "Well, why is that?" And he goes, "Well, then I didn't have to do one of those CMHC subprime mortgages." And again, it's like, "So what do you mean?" He goes, "Well, if it's high ratio, that's subprime, right?" And it just made me realize the vast amount of, let's say, lack of knowledge of what this really meant was scary across the country. Yet everybody was being impacted and continues to be. So let's go back and say, what is a subprime mortgage? First and foremost, a subprime mortgage means that the person borrowing the money is below prime. It's a below prime candidate. So let's say you are an average individual in Canada, you get a job, and you know, you're self-employed, but you can qualify for a standard mortgage. You can go into any of the chartered banks and get qualified for a mortgage. Well, that would be what's called a normal prime mortgage or a conventional mortgage, whether it's high ratio or conventional. Now, let's say that you've had a bankruptcy issue or some credit issues, or you know, you can't verify income and you have some credit issues. Then what happened was, in the United States, they started developing more aggressive lending practices, and this became known as subprime lending. These were lenders who were not the charter banks, not your average, you know, run-of-the-mill lender. These guys basically say, you know what, there's a whole market out there of people who, if we can help them get into home ownership, they've got some tarnished credit or they got some inability to verify income. But you know what, with real estate going up, and remember, this all started in the early 2000s. Well, what was happening to real estate prices? Yeah, shooting up in a straight line, right? So if I'm a lender in 2004 in certain markets in the United States, and I'm sitting there going, well, Russell, you come to me and you've been laid off, or you can't verify, or you have no job. I look at this and I say, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a zero down real estate a mortgage today, because you put down zero down today, within 3 or 4 months in some markets, that might be 100% financing when I do the financing, but by the time 3 months goes by, as a lender, the value of the house has gone up, so my exposure has decreased.
And as we all know, markets go up, markets go down, but over the long-term period, you know, real estate has proven to be a great trend line. But on the short-term basis, sometimes markets go down, and that's what they're finding.
Absolutely.
with some solid.
Well, and now let's analyze. And this got to the point of extreme. There's two factors that really kicked in here, Russ. Number one, on the surface, you understand, okay, yeah, there's the subprime clients. Who lenders say, well, let's create aggressive products to help these people get into home ownership. Well, there's two key components that happened in the United States that did not take effect here in Canada but are very critical to the process. Number one, on the surface, somebody would say, well, that's, you know, it's obvious what their problem was. I mean, they're giving zero down to clients in a market where it's an upside market and it would burn them in the downside market. Why would the lenders keep doing that? Well, first of all, the mortgage brokers and the mortgage lenders who were packaging and presenting these products to the general public were not the lenders who would hold that mortgage at the end of the day.
Yeah.
They would
have no responsibility to it.
Exactly.
The person
who
wrote it packaged it up and sold it to someone else, and they had no more responsibility to it.
Exactly. So what was happening is it was part of the culture of greed, if you will, that was pervasive throughout the world, not just the United States, but throughout the world, where mutual funds, hedge funds, all these other investment vehicles were hungry for higher rates of return. So what they would look at is they said, wow, look at all these American subprime mortgages. They're getting 8, 9, 10% interest rates. And they could package it up in a bundle of goods. Because remember, here, what people forget is a mortgage, when you sign a contract for a mortgage, what you're signing is a promise to pay X dollars a month over X term.
Essentially, so it's a cash flow stream, essentially.
Exactly. It's an annuity. And so I could come in and, Russell, let's say you had sold 100 mortgages, which means you've got promises to pay, 100 people are promising you to pay you X dollars a month. Well, I could buy that cash flow stream off you, and without getting into complex financing, you know, we can figure out what the present value of that money is and discount it, and you could package these bundles up and sell them to investor groups, which will put them as part of a mutual fund or put them as part of a hedge fund. And what was happening is called collateralized debt instruments. And
they gave them more fancier names than that, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely.
High-grade, leveraged, high-yield investments and AAA bond ratings on them. And
well, and there's the whole problem. They got the bond agencies. Basically, the whole thing slipped through the cracks. And what was happening is hedge funds and mutual funds were buying these, and what they would bundle them, and they were basically high-yielding debt instruments. And they would throw in car loans, credit card debt, and other things. It's a whole complete bundle of goods. And it got so ludicrous that my thing is, I don't think they saw the forest through the trees. Because what happened was, and I'll give you the ultimate example that I like to use, in California, you know, imagine this, these lenders, the more they can lend out, the more they can bundle up and sell it off. I mean, there's nothing on their books. They have no liability. They have no responsibility at the end of the day on their books as mortgage companies, because they've sold it to the client on one end, they've bundled up, packaged it, and sold it to investors out the back door, and they're left. You know, they made their cut or their fee in the middle, and they're whistling Dixie. And they got so aggressive with this. In California, there was an actual product that came out, and they called it a ninja mortgage. And again, I'm not making this up, because you can't make this stuff up.
What does ninja stand for, Pete?
Ninja stands for no income, no job, no assets, no problem.
All right.
And
at the heart of the matter, the lending was being done to people that could not afford to pay back.
Absolutely, and not only on a small scale, it was on a massive scale. The subprime mortgage as a percentage of the penetration in the American market became 25%. And I want you to, everybody listening,
so one in every
please
four
pause
mortgages.
And think of it.
So one
Sorry?
In every four mortgages written in the States was one of these types of mortgages.
Yeah, and think about that. Take a second, think about that. In some cases, entire neighborhoods. So one in four, I mean, walk out your front door and look, two houses to your left, two houses to your right, one of those people would have a subprime mortgage.
Wow.
And
so what about, Canada? What was the highest number you've seen that is estimated that went into some kind of subprime mortgages?
And here's the key is that in the Canadian market, these products, there was a hunger for more. Well, first of all, Canadian banks are just so ultra-conservative. They've been the international joke for being conservative, and now part of the reason why they're strong today is because of their previous reputation for being ultra-conservative. But even there was this need and hunger for Canadians to say, can't we get what the American counterparts have? And it seeped over the line, but only to the degree of 5%. And
that was the highest number I've seen, too.
The highest number is 5% of Canadian mortgages, and even the subprime mortgages that came across, there was no ninja products up here. They were still conservative by American standards. And even the conservative subprime mortgages only represented less than 5% of the Canadian marketplace, as opposed to aggressive subprime mortgages in the United States representing 25%. I mean, again, now we look back, and it's like, oh, my goodness, who could possibly have been so foolish and stupid? Well, and again, worldwide, a bit of a greed was pervasive throughout all markets, hunger for higher returns. People really just became blind to the obvious, which
so
was...
Even if there was a subprime, so only 5% was written that we say that would be a subprime. If less than 20 to 25% was put down, it still had to be insured by CMHC, and you had to go through a very rigorous criteria process to get that done.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and again, we could go on and on about how the differences are there, and they are immense.
One of the things here, you mentioned earlier about securitization, where American banks took their mortgages, had no accountability, then sold it off to other people. I just actually read a stat that I was quite surprised that in Canada, 96% of the loans that Canadian banks write stay on their books. So
exactly.
So
and that means they're not selling them out the back door.
So they have to be accountable to their balance sheet to make sure that it gets paid back.
And that's a huge difference, whereas American banks didn't have to be, and especially in the subprime category. And again, remember, if we look back, what triggered this back in August of 2007, and what really shocked the world was suddenly, started out with Bear Stearns hedge fund, and then all of a sudden this hedge fund out of France. Paris, France hedge fund all of a sudden stands up and says, we're going bankrupt because we're holding too much of this collateralized debt instruments. Within there are U.S. subprime mortgages, and of course,
people say, "Well, what's this all about?"
Yeah, and all of a sudden, everybody wakes up and says, "Well, how much of this subprime stuff is in my bundle of goods?" Because here's where those bond agencies, those rating agencies, failed in the safety measure. They didn't. There was no need to do, for these banks and investor groups that were bundling these mortgages along with credit card debt and auto loan debt, when they were bundling these and selling them to hedge funds and mutual funds, what they didn't have to do is there was no requirement for them to disclose the exposure, the degree of exposure to the subprime market.
Right.
And no
and
one was asking.
They probably significantly overvalued it, and then all of a sudden the economics came home to roost and people said, well, let's put a value on this, a real value on it, and then all of a sudden balance sheets took a tumble and people couldn't borrow. Yeah, it's...
And then the one real big coup de grace that really was a kicker on all this. And again, in hindsight, you kind of go, well, what were they smoking? You know, this is so obvious in hindsight, but they had this thing called loan reset terms in the United States, where you got into the subprime mortgage today, and I don't want to call it teaser rates, because we have teaser rates that are legitimate in Canada, where it is actually a lower rate. They would give these clients who couldn't afford to pay the mortgage in the first place a discount to pay a lower amount up front, but it wasn't a discount on the rate. It was actually deferring the rate.
Well,
and the rate
even
would
to the
be,
point, wasn't there adjustable payment plans that you could name what you're going to pay, and you could pay even less than the interest that's...
Oh, yes. So it's called negative amortization.
Yeah, so your mortgage actually went up every month. I guess
you
could make up for that.
More.
You can accomplish your wealth goals with a lot of those if you make up for it with volume.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's take a look into some of the things that's been. I know we talked a little bit about what's happening south of the border, but that's a good benchmark to show where what's going on. But also let's take a look at on the north side up here in Canada for investors. We had. There was a big announcement that came out about the elimination of the zero down and 40-year amortization mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thought on those?
Well, again, it's all fallout because and part of the whole subprime, we talked about what created the subprime crisis. You know, fast forward a year down the road, and what you have is a liquidity issue. And the reason we have a liquidity issue is because those investors that were standing up to buy the mortgages off the books are basically gun shy, and they're concerned, and they're not in a position to buy the mortgages from different lenders today, and it has impacts commercial financing and residential financing, and it impacts Canadian banks as well. So the Bank of Canada looked at this and said, we need to show that these potential investors that we are going to be more responsible than our American counterparts. So as a knee-jerk reaction to almost a display of almost to show, like, hey, look at us. We're taking action. We're taking aggressive steps to curb irresponsible lending. They said, well, let's eliminate the zero down option and take away the 40-year option.
Yep. Very prudent, and also a little bit of a political maneuvering as well, posturing. But at the end of the day, it was a very prudent decision.
Yeah, I mean, well, I have mixed views there, Russ, because I think we have to separate them. We have to separate the zero down and the 40-year amp. And
okay, let me just quickly ask you a question. Zero down, I know you've talked about this at many, many workshops, that you actually weren't a big fan of them, because at the end of the day, if you put down no money, your cash flow takes a huge hit on your portfolio that impacts your next opportunity. In your office, the number two mortgage broker across Canada, dealing with real estate investors,
mm-hmm.
out of ballpark percentage of the deals that you have done would be a zero down mortgage?
For real estate investors, less than 1%.
Less than 1%.
Less than
1%. Not really that big of a deal, is it?
For me, it's not at all, and I'm a huge proponent of getting rid of it. And I'll tell you why. If I'm a real estate investor, putting zero down is short-term thinking. It's a Band-Aid solution, and it's not addressing the real issue. I mean, I have this conversation, the same conversation I had with you when I first met you. I have it with every real estate investor approaches us, is tell me your goals. And, Russ, it blows me away that, you know, in virtually every case, very rarely do I have somebody say, my goal is to buy one property. That's it. And I would suspect that everybody listening to this is probably going to say, well, no, I want to buy more than one. It's probably in anywhere between 5 and 50, but let's say somebody says, I want to buy 15 properties, and they say, well, I want, and they're coming at me, and they're saying, the first one I want zero down. So let me ask you, how do you plan to buy the other 14? Because you're not going to get 14 zero down deals. First of all, you need to be willing to allow it.
We do teach there are ways of getting into a deal without your own money. There are definitely ways of doing that. If you're looking at just with this one product, this one tool, essentially, you're going zero down, and the fees on it weren't the fees somewhere up around 7% almost?
Well, there's 7%, and you're actually, and it's tacked onto the mortgage, so you're really getting 107% financing. So, I mean, imagine anybody in Edmonton last year who got 107% financing in 2007, and now that your price has kind of dropped off. So now you're probably 120% exposed. And that's the type of thing that is not really, and that's really where the banks were saying this is not good. But even for you as an investor, it's not good. And more important, if you're going to build, it gets back to what I said right in the beginning, how I developed my business. There's the average banker and broker will look at your deal from a transactional approach. And you as a real estate investor, quite frankly, you don't have the luxury of having that short-term mentality. Because if you look at this as a simple transaction, yeah, maybe we can get you qualified on this one zero down deal. But how's that? If you're putting zero down, what's happening to the cash flow on the property? And the one thing I know, Russ, is that if I'm working with someone such as yourself or anybody who's looking to buy more than 5 or 10 or 15 properties over a period of time, to continue to qualify, especially in today's market where it's getting tighter, to continue to qualify for those mortgages, the strength of that portfolio now, more so than ever before, is becoming paramount. It's important to show that you have positive surplus cash flow in your portfolio. So if putting zero down, the only time I recommend zero down would make sense, if somebody's buying a fourplex or a extremely excellent cash flowing property,
right,
where the cash flow, even with zero down, still is positive, and if it works with the overall picture, and you can still move on and get the next deal after that, then fine. But if it drives your property into negative cash flowing territory, then I would prefer you figured out, you know, go to Quick Start, go to Rain, and learn how to develop joint venture partner and other, learn that secret, learn the tools that Rain will teach you on joint venturing, and learn how to put no money in yourself, but leverage off of bringing in a joint venture partner and have the joint venture partner put 20% down, and you're going to be able to qualify for multiple mortgages over time.
Absolutely. Now, we broke that into two, so maybe talk a little bit about the now, I know this is one that I used quite a bit, was the 40-year amortization,
mm-hmm.
and I used it from a standpoint of to manage my cash flow. That has now been eliminated. And what's the longest amortization we can get now?
Well, you know, two things there, Russ. Number one, I think we have to really be very clear when people say the 40-year am is eliminated. Well, it's not. I mean, I don't like using the word eliminated. It's been cut back to 35.
Okay.
And so you still get 35 years, and 18 months ago your best option was only 25 years. So
right.
Let's forget that. For
the difference between a 35 and a 40-year amortization, on $100,000 is about, what is it, about less than $20 a month?
Yeah, I think it worked out to $20 or $33. I don't have the number in front of me, but it wasn't, you know, hey, it's great if you can get it, but it's not a major issue. It shouldn't make or break your deal, let's put it that way.
Bottom line is, we can, as real estate investors, we still can get 35s, and a year and a half to 2 years ago, the best we could do is 25, and quite honestly, I think that's the pendulum went too far. It's come back. I still think it's in our favor.
Oh, absolutely. And the only other thing I was going to say about that is, as much as I think what the government did by stepping in and eliminating the zero down, I was 100% behind that. As for 40-year amortization, that was just political saber rattling, and having a 40-year amortization had absolutely no bearing on the subprime crisis, and there was no relevance, and I don't think it helps the banks at all. There was absolutely nothing wrong with a 40-year amortization, in my opinion.
If someone goes out there and gets a 40-year amortization, does that mean they're locked in for 40 years?
No, and that's exactly my point. In fact, the average Canadian will either refinance, renew, or move or change their mortgage in 3.5 years. So, I mean, you heard financial planners just lambasting this in the newspapers and in the headlines a 40-year amortization increases the cost of borrowing over 40 years by almost double. And it's like, if you actually took 40 years to pay off that mortgage. But the reality is, I would challenge any RAIN member who's buying a rental property, to take a second and think, how long are you actually going to hold that property? Do you plan to hold it for 40 years? The likelihood is not. And besides that, what term of the mortgage, whether you had a variable rate or a fixed rate, the likelihood is, the majority of people take 5-year terms. And again, this is what differentiates Canada from the United States. In the United States, when they have 30, 35, 40-year mortgages, they're actually 30, 35, and 40-year terms.
Yep.
And whereas we have a 5-year term, you could re-amortize that property 5 years down the road. But in the meantime, having the opportunity to amortize over 40 years may increase cash flow or increase affordability.
Well, I know one of the things and this is just a personal story, what I've done, just bought a brand new personal residence. I put a 40-year amortization mortgage on it, and the number one reason why I did that is I wanted my payment on paper, that I'm contracted to pay the bank on paper, to be the lowest possible. And the reason why I want it to be the lowest is because I'm qualifying for mortgages, and I want my home mortgage to be as low as possible, to show my debt service ratios, debt coverage ratios, and make them as favorable as possible. What I am actually doing is I'm making lump sum payments to my mortgage on either 2 months or 1 month, depending on the extra cash flow I have sitting around. Plus, with the drops in the interest rates that have just happened, I just checked, my amortization has dropped from in less than 6 months. My amortization now is in the 22-year range from 40. And I haven't changed anything.
Yeah, and what you're doing is you're doing an excellent job of managing your personal mortgage, and that's what I encourage people to do, is manage your mortgage portfolio, which is why I refer to it as portfolio mortgage strategy. And what you just described is absolutely bang on. And again, two things. Number one, I think the fact that they took away the 40-year amortization was political saber rattling. In other words, has absolutely no bearing on the whole big picture. But having said that, they took it away. We're down to 35. Not a big deal. We still have 35-year AMs.
Move on.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people that will be listening to on this call are people that will have a portfolio and have a large portfolio of mortgages. Some of them, can look around at people and, they're sitting at $14, $20, $30, $50 million of mortgages. And that right there is, in essence, a portfolio and an investment portfolio. That just learning one or two things on that can literally save you thousands of dollars a month in cash flow. Mm-hmm. Or just doing the wrong actions can literally add years and years onto repaying it back. So education, as you mentioned earlier, is very key. Okay, next point I want to get into. We've had report and also an announcement. Global banks all got together and they did a massive half a percentage point drop on interest rates. And then Canada itself went and did another quarter. You know, multiple questions here, but what was your thoughts on the when the global banks got together and offered something of the half a percentage point drop?
Well, I mean, clearly it's historical in its proportion. I mean, we've never, the only other time that this has ever happened that the Bank of Canada has gotten together outside of a predetermined rate announcement. In other words, the Bank of Canada will meet like five or six times a year. For example, they meet on October 17th and then, or, you know, December 9th, I think is the next one. They're predetermined dates, right? There's only been one instance that they've met outside of those predetermined dates, and that was the September 11th terrorist attacks.
Right.
So the fact that they did this 2 weeks ago really puts it in that category in terms of historical perspective. It's a little unnerving for the average individual when you see global lenders and bankers working on a collaborative basis to say we have to address a global credit crisis here. So on one hand, you know, there's a global credit crisis and all the kerfuffle that you're going to have out there in the marketplace, and you know, we've certainly seen the TSX and the New York Stock Exchange reacting accordingly. But what I like to do is say, okay, well, let's bring this down to earth for us as Canadians, and in particular, if you're listening on this call, what does it mean to you as a real estate investor? Well, at the end of the day, what it means is your interest rates just got cheaper if you currently have a variable rate mortgage.
If you have a current variable rate mortgage in the marketplace right now, like I know I have a couple that are 0.9 below prime.
Exactly.
And if prime is 4.
And if you're prime below, well, I don't know if you recall.
I keep waiting for the day that they're going to start giving me money. No, it'll never happen. But.
If you wait a while, my friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, again, it's perspective. So let's say you're in the market, and again, and Russ, you remember I was teaching this for how long, the concept of a front-end loaded variable.
Mm-hmm.
Where you load up the discount up on the front end, and in some cases people are getting 2% off or 1.5% off for 5, 6, 9 months or a year. And this was a product that was available in the marketplace in the past year, and I was my thoughts were that rates will dip a little and then go up, and I still believe, and we'll talk about that later, where rates will go. I still believe it's going to swing back on the upside. But if you took I was talking to one of my clients just last week, and he got in to the front-end loaded variable at 1.5% below prime, and now that prime has dropped to 4%, he's paying 2.5% on his mortgage right now.
Yeah,
and I said,
you know, if he doesn't change his payments, it'll be just, most of it will be going towards
accelerating debt reduction.
Accelerating debt reduction, and the most important time to have the accelerated debt reduction is at the beginning of your mortgage. So.
And then you just watch that. If the rates shift like we expect them to do and they start to climb upwards, then you convert it, lock it in at no cost, and you know, you've gained the maximum benefit from this particular, what is it, crisis. You know, here's a big thing. I'm telling people, you know, crisis or opportunity. When the rest of the world's all uptight about the crisis, you should be looking at the opportunity. And because every crisis brings an opportunity. So we as real estate investors, it's time for us to say, okay, what's the opportunity in this rather than, you know, putting fuel on the fire and saying, oh, you know, what, running around like the Chicken Littles, that the sky is falling.
I'm a firm believer right now that in my lifetime, I think I'm probably going to witness the largest transfer of wealth that I will probably see in my lifetime. So as you mentioned, I fully agree with you that there is huge opportunity right now. But before we get on to the next question, a couple quick comments on, so back it up a little bit for those of you following at home on the scorecard. Global banks reduced the interest rate by 0.5%, but not all Canadian banks followed suit. What's your opinion on why they didn't follow suit?
Well, you know, Russ, it's an interesting thing that's been an ongoing issue here for a while with Canadian banks, and it can get into some complex understanding of how the banks lend money to each other, and it's part of what's called interbank lending. You've heard the term LIBOR come up, and it's the London Interbank overnight rate. And we have, when the Bank of Canada drops their rate, most people think the Bank of Canada drops prime. Well, that's not true. The Bank of Canada drops the overnight lending rate. And this is the rate that is charged from bank to bank. And, you know, it's all part and parcel of this entire credit, lack of liquidity in the marketplace out there. So a few months back when the liquidity tightened up, and again, this goes right back to what we said earlier when the subprime lenders were bundling up these packages and selling them to investor groups, and then the investor groups were getting burned because they didn't realize their exposure to subprime debt. Well, now they're so gun-shy, these investor groups aren't buying any of that money. Well, what that's done is created a lack of liquidity in the marketplace. So one bank lends money to another bank, and now they're not as confident they're going to get that money lent back to them as they were before. So what they do is they increase the rate of lending in between lenders.
So the cost.
So it's called your cost of borrowing.
Right.
And without delving into heavier economics, let's just say there's an increased cost of borrowing for banks. And this is the money they use to lend out on the variable rates. So on a variable rate mortgage, the cost to banks is, in some cases, they're actually losing money. So you know, you and I both benefited a year ago from having prime minus 0.9 or prime minus 90, as we would say in the industry.
Yep.
This is a, you know, here's prime rate. The average bank would take a discount off of that, and then there is your variable rate. So, you know, for you and me getting mortgage, the question wasn't, well, what's how much? The question when you asked, got a variable rate mortgage was really, how much below prime is my best deal?
Right.
And what was happening is they started realizing, because the interbank cost of borrowing increased, that if they sold the mortgages below prime, they would be losing money. So the banks had two choices, Russ. Number one, they could take that interbank or the overnight lending rate that the Bank of Canada dropped and not pass on that savings to the client. In other words,
sure,
when the Bank of Canada drops by half a point, they said, well, we'll only drop a quarter point.
Right.
So that's choice number one, right?
Which they did for a couple days, didn't they?
Yeah, but what happened? This is really fascinating, quite frankly, because I am blown away by the lack of a spotlight on this whole thing. And I'll tell you a quick theory I have here. I think that the issue is that, as we said before, everybody knew that the Bank of Canada was going to meet on October 21st. That was the preset time. They know they're going to meet again on December 9th, and they know they're going to meet again in January. So these are predetermined dates. And there's a huge buildup, right? They talk about the Bank of Canada is going to meet on Tuesday. We're going to anticipate a half point or quarter point rate drop or whatever. Everybody's speculating what Mr. Carney and company will do. And what happens, you got this huge national media spotlight on that one isolated event.
Yeah.
So when the Bank of Canada drops interest rates, it's immediately expected that the banks will follow suit. And when they don't, the spotlight's right on them and say, well, why aren't you passing these savings along?
Yeah.
And they got to get into some complex conversation about the LIBOR and overnight lending rate and the interbank exchange, which,
yep,
that, you know, it doesn't fly, right? It's hard to report that in the media. So it's easier to report while the banks are being stingy and not passing on the savings. And, of course, the public outcry
is, we're trying to make up for lost money that we have in the stock market.
Yeah, exactly. So but I think there's a legitimate loss there for the banks. So what they've done is, and here's the neat part. I shouldn't say neat part. To me, I find a fascinating part that the media and the general public misses is, Russ, the banks kind of say, you know what? Everybody's crawling over this quarter point. Give it to them. Give it to them. Let's drop our prime and match what the Bank of Canada does. Well, what did they do on the flip side? Remember you and I got a prime minus 90 mortgage last year? Well,
yep.
Try going and get that today. In 1 week, while all this was going on, we went, and as a mortgage broker, I lost my ability to have a discount off prime. The emails started flooding in a flurry. In a three-day period, here's what happened. One bank says, we're no longer offering a discount off of prime for variable rate. So you want a variable rate? It's going to be at prime. The next day, sorry, it's not at prime anymore. It's at prime plus 1%.
Prime plus 1.
And then on the third day, three lenders sent us emails and saying, we're actually suspending variable rates altogether and they're not even available in the market anymore.
Wow. Things that were taking years to change are now changing in weeks.
Wow, and that was a three-day period.
Yeah,
but what was interesting, Russ?
Half a week.
Yeah, and Russ, but here's the thing that baffled me. Not one single headline in the news.
Yeah.
So they're basically, the entire Canadian market is squabbling over a quarter point, they didn't lower prime by a quarter point. Well, in the meantime, the banks have increased the variable cost of getting a new variable rate by almost 2%.
Yeah.
And not even a blip in the market. No one ever batted an eye.
The analogy I used with a client the other week was, it probably was about a year and a half ago when prime was sitting at 6%. And it was at 6% for a long period of time. It's probably, in the last 10 years, it was probably one of the longest periods of a non-change to prime. And it was sitting at 6. At that time, the best we probably could have got was prime minus 0.75. So we were sitting at about 5.25. And I remember my interest rates on my mortgages were 5.25 for the longest period of time.
Yeah.
Right now, prime is at 4. It's prime plus 1. So we're getting 5% on a variable rate right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still better off than we were about a year and a half to 2 years ago. Although, don't like to have prime plus anything. But this too shall pass. This, like the pendulum we talk about, is swinging rapidly both ways. So quick question for you on fixed rate mortgages. Lib, we've talked about Bank of Canada and the prime fixed rates. What's your take on that?